The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
Welcome, everybody. Nice to see you here tonight. So many of you probably have heard of James. You told me today I've been mispronouncing his last name for the last how many years? Verres. There I go. James Verres. And some of you know he's one of the founding teachers at Spirit Rock Meditation Center, just north of San Francisco, one of the main centers in the Vipassana tradition here in the States. And James is also one of our members of our advisory board and has been an important teacher of mine. I'd just like to share a couple qualities that have been really important for me just in knowing James over the years, not so much recently, but especially during 3 or 4 years I was involved in a program that James initiated through Spirit Rock called the Community Dharma Leaders Program. But one is, and he reminded me again today, but I remember during my time when I was seeing James more regularly, just his capacity to see what was beautiful. And it was really contagious just being around him. Both, you know, his ability to see something beautiful in me, and I saw him see beautiful things in other people, and in a way that it was easy for us to see or for me to see and feel. Beautiful dolls. That's beautiful.
I agree.
And then the other quality that has been really powerful for me to see in just being around James is just the power of confidence to be himself. And it's not something we often say in a Buddhist setting, because we don't, you know, what does that mean, be oneself? But just comfortable in his own skin, not taking it personally, but not afraid of the personality and the life and the situations. And I've really seen him modeling, just kind of rolling with life and being comfortable in life and comfortable in his own skin. And that's been a really powerful lesson for me, just being around James. And so some of you know, a number of people in the community, maybe some of you in the future, will take James's online course, Awakening Joy. There's some flyers out in the entranceway. You can find out more about this 10-month course. But this is one of the ways James has been teaching in the last several years, and now with the book. And so fortunately we get to see him because he's out promoting the book and getting it out there for people to hear about. And so tonight James is going to be talking about Awakening Joy. And thanks so much for coming, James. Really lovely to have you here.
Well, it is a real treat to be here in a number of ways. First, just to reconnect with you, Mark, and just to see what a thriving, healthy, beautiful community you have, and just what you've done with sharing the Dharma from your heart. And it's not surprising, but it's great to see firsthand. And also to meet the people that I've met so far. You really know how to take care of somebody. At least I've felt that. So thanks to everybody who's been so gracious. So I will talk about this topic of awakening joy, and I'll want to leave time for discussion. Really, what the book is about and what the course is about is ways to see that this path is a path of happiness. That the Dharma, the practices that we're doing, is really about happiness. And I was motivated to write and to explore and develop some practices to make them accessible to anyone, whether or not they've done any meditation. Out of my own experience, where as much as I have been moved by Buddha Dharma, I first got into the teachings in 1974, and it was my salvation. I was in a lot of suffering, internal suffering, and when I came to the practice, it was like there was a way out of suffering, and I really went for it. And for quite some time was had a long honeymoon phase, but as much as I had that experience, at some point I became very serious with my practice. Dead serious. And I lost my joy. I somehow got I interpreted messages that kind of, I got tangled up with the end of suffering with the end of living. And I became, I'm a kind of person that likes to enjoy life. And in fact, one of the things that first got me hooked on is I'm just trying to see what stories to tell is one that's coming through. One of the things that first got me hooked on the practice, when my first summer in 1974, when I met Joseph Goldstein, my teacher and the main teacher of Marx and many, many others, in that first summer, I was wondering, is this for me? I knew it was for me. It felt really right. But one afternoon, I went into that first essential Buddhism class, and I had my New York Knicks T-shirt on, and I was a season ticket holder for the New York Knicks at the time. This is their glory days, like 1973, 74. If you remember, if you're old enough, Dave DeBuscher and Willis Reed and Walt Frazier and Earl the Pearl was my favorite player. But I would go to, that was one of my, well, probably a number of my top 10 moments in my life were in Madison Square Garden. And there I was this one afternoon sitting in Joseph's class, and I remembered, I realized, oh, I had my Knicks shirt, and this awful thought came to me that motivated me to go up to speak to Joseph for the very first time. I finally mustered up the courage because it was like, wow, he was this amazing meditation teacher. I said, look, Joseph, I've got something to check out with you. I'm a season ticket holder. And I wonder, is this going to lead me? Am I going to go to Madison Square Garden and say, nice shot, Frazier. Very good move, Havlicek. Because I wasn't ready to sign up for it if that was where it was leading. And he gave the perfect answer. He said, don't worry, you'll probably just get over a loss a little bit sooner. Okay. I'm in. I'm going for it. And as I say, it was my salvation. But when I got very serious about practice, I somehow lost that that aliveness. This is not something unique to me. It's something that can be one of the dangers in taking practice very seriously, because there are some messages that say not to get so caught up in the dazzle of life that you get swept away and don't see a deeper happiness. There's one word, for instance, in the teachings, nibbida, N-I-B-B-I-D-A, that sometimes is translated as one should have utter disgust for the five aggregates, for this mind-body process, or revulsion for the mind-body process of this form and other forms. But as Andy Olinsky points out, it's a wonderful Buddhist scholar and teacher, teaches at the study center in Barrie. He said those are two translations for this word, but the real meaning of nibbida is disenchantment. One should have disenchantment. One should one should break the spell of the seduction of this form. That doesn't mean to have utter disgust for it, but it's easy in teachings like that to have a misunderstanding and think, oh, it's not okay to enjoy life. And in fact, I want to share with you one of my favorite quotes. This is from Ajahn Sumedho, a wonderful, well-respected, the most respected Theravadan monastic, Western monastic, and one of the most respected of any monastics alive. And this is what he says. Sometimes in Theravada Buddhism, one gets the impression that you shouldn't enjoy beauty. If you see a beautiful flower, you should contemplate its decay. Or if you see a beautiful woman, you should contemplate her as a rotting corpse. This has a certain value on one level, but it's not a fixed position to take. It's not that we should feel compelled to reject beauty and dwell on its impermanence and on how it changes to being not so beautiful and then downright repulsive. This is a good reflection on anicca, dukkha, and anatta, on impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness of life, and the selfless nature of reality. But it can leave the impression that beauty is only to be reflected on in terms of these three characteristics, rather than in terms of the experience of beauty. This is really joy, being able to appreciate the beauty in the things around us. People who can't see the beauty of the good or the true are really bitter and mean, and they live in an ugly realm where there's no rejoicing in beauty and goodness and truth. Once you have insight, then you find that you enjoy, delight in the beauty and the goodness of things. Truth, beauty, and goodness delight us. In them we find joy. So this is something that I saw when I reclaimed my joy and when I got it back. I asked myself the question, where did I go wrong? What did the Buddha really say about happiness? Because the Buddha was called the happy one. And in fact, he said, go for the highest happiness, and all the other ones will come, and you can experience them and appreciate them. The Dalai Lama starts out his wonderful book, The Art of Happiness. The first line in the book, the purpose of life is to be happy. Which is a great way to start a book, I think. So, where, I wondered, did I go wrong? And more than, I saw where I went wrong, more than that, what did the Buddha really say about happiness and joy? Because joy is one of the seven factors of enlightenment. Suffering is not a factor of enlightenment. Joy is one of the four divine abodes, along with loving kindness and compassion and equanimity. Joy is one of a number of words that describes a whole continuum of states of well-being, from gladness, delight, pamoja, and rapture, piti, and happiness, sukha, and there's different kinds of contentment and peace. So this is something that's really valued. So I took a look, and in the process saw a few different really powerful teachings for me that I wanted to not only practice for myself, but also share with others, so people could see who might tend to get on the more serious side, that although the path is talked about as suffering, understanding suffering and the end of suffering, you know, the Four Noble Truths, there is suffering in life, there's a cause of suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a path to the end of suffering. Sometimes it's hard to remember, oh, this is about happiness. it doesn't get as much airplay. So I wanted to really reorient and see this is really about opening up to as much well-being as we can. The key is to know where happiness, what true happiness is, and where it really lies. So I took a few different principles and practiced them for myself and then wanted to share them with others, and that's what this course is about, and the book is based on the course. Actually, I started writing the book and then writing about this topic, and then I put together a course to just check out my theories, but the course seemed to be helpful and it grew, and it grew a lot, so the book became about the course because I was getting a lot of more information as I did the course. By the way, I just want to put in a word about the course. Mark said that there are those sheets out there that tell about it. It's a 10-month course that you can take online. More people take it online than live. And there is a suggested donation, but people can offer whatever they want for it. And it seems to work if you put your intention into it. So the key is to see where happiness lies. It does not lie in where we've been pointed and saying this will make you happy. The Buddha was talking 2,500 years ago, watch out for being entranced by things and objects and experiences as a cause of happiness. Well, now it's been elevated to a high art to seduce and entrance us. And I share with you an ad that I mentioned in the book, but you get to see the picture that it's from, to just show you what we're up against. This is called The Gold Shivers, a beautiful woman draped in gold. It's a 2-page ad. The gold shivers, that electric excitement, that thrilling warmth. Every new piece of gold jewelry ignites it once again. Nothing makes you feel as good as gold. Now the second page, you can see the picture. What is the real substance of a new piece of gold jewelry? Emotion, pure and powerful. From the first small shiver of excitement when a shimmering necklace of gold beads catches a woman's eye, to the great shivers of delight when the coveted object actually becomes hers. Among life's pleasures, count this deeply felt euphoria as unique. The only way to get the gold shivers is by getting the gold. This is what we're up against. And according to one book, Culture Jam by Colleen Lassen, the average American gets 3,000 messages every day saying, this is going to make you happy. You think you're happy. You're not happy. This is going to make you happy. Unless you're on retreat, then it's lunchtime. This will make you happy. So if that's not where real happiness lies, where does it? Well, the Buddha said that happiness is not about what you can get. There are certain states of well-being that are already in us. Joy is already in us. You were born into this world with that capacity. And if you see a baby with its diapers changed and fed and taken care of, who's received a minimal amount of love and care, they squeal with delight. Isn't life wonderful, right? We all have had that capacity, and we have that capacity. And so this is more and more uncovering what's in here. And what the teachings point to are different wholesome states that are called wholesome, kusala, that are called wholesome because they lead to well-being and happiness, as opposed to unwholesome states, akusala, that are those that lead to suffering. Akusala, unwholesome states like anger, jealousy, greed, envy, confusion. You know those, right? The mind gets very contracted and can't see, and the heart closes. Wholesome states like kindness, generosity, compassion, patience, all of those have to do with opening, expanding the heart. And so as we open and expand, then we can allow that natural joy to emerge. That factor of enlightenment, that quality of well-being that naturally arises when the mind is not contracted and confused. So the three principles that struck me that I have put together as the cornerstone of the book and the course. One principle, the teaching on wise effort. Wise effort, if you are familiar with it, is one of the links of the Eightfold Path. And what wise effort technically means is guarding against unwholesome states, overcoming them when they have arisen. You know, you have anger. How can you deal with anger so that it's not overwhelming and so you can hold it in a different way? Those are two aspects of wise effort. And then other two, developing wholesome states that aren't here, like you might do loving kindness practice or mindfulness practice. Lots of different generosity practices. You can develop those. And the fourth aspect of wise effort is to maintain and increase wholesome states when they've arisen. This is a good thing, the Buddha said. This is one aspect of wise effort. When you're feeling in a state of well-being, it's supportive and wise to maintain and increase that state. Now you might say, well, doesn't that sound like attachment? This is not about attachment. The moment that you get attached to the state, you're contracting, and it's the surest way to have it end. But there are ways to maintain and increase that wholesome state that are skillful. So this is the first principle, to develop and to maintain and increase the wholesome states. And what I write about, the book is called 10 Steps That Will Put You on the Road to Real Happiness, that's the subtitle, After Awakening Joy, is focus on 10 different wholesome states that one can practice over time and notice those states of well-being. As you start to do that, you're maintaining and increasing them. Okay, so that's it. Developing and increasing wholesome states, that's one principle. Second teaching, the Buddha talks about the fact that along with these wholesome states, there's a gladness that accompanies them. And this, I came across this in a not so well-known discourse a number of years ago, but the words kind of leaped out at me. If for those the sutta scholars or those interested in that, it's in Majjhima 99, Tisubha. And the words that the Buddha says, he says, if you're in the middle of a generous act, one should think to oneself, I am generous. He says, get in touch with the fact, oh, I'm being generous right now. And as you reflect on this, there's a gladness connected with the wholesome state. Through that gladness, one gains inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the truth, inspiration in the Dharma. And it opens the heart. That gladness, the words go, I call an equipment of mind to overcome ill will and hostility. So when you're in the middle of that feeling of well-being, to notice the gladness. He's not saying, hey, everybody see how generous I am? Hey, I'm a pretty generous guy. No, 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 no. That's kind of missing the point. He's saying, feel how good it feels for generosity to arise in you. And when you're in touch with that gladness, it is an antidote to overcome all ill will and hostility, because the heart opens with that. So this second principle I have found very, very helpful when you're in the middle of a state of well-being. Rather than knowing that you're feeling good, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good, to feel what it's like to feel good is the key. To truly take it in, as my friend Rick Hansen, has Rick been here? No. Who was in one of the community Dharma Leader programs and is a neuroscience expert. He wrote a book that's become quite popular lately called Buddha's Brain, about the intersection of neuroscience and Dharma and psychology. And there's neuroscience throughout the book. He calls it taking in the good, that when you're very present for the wholesome state, it deepens the neural pathways in your brain and in your whole being. That to really explore the landscape of it and savor it, not with attachment, just, oh, this is what it feels like to feel good. It's a very potent way to anchor that feeling. And you start to become more and more aware of it, and it suffuses you with well-being. That's taking in the gladness of the wholesome. Those two principles, and then the third principle is the Buddha's teaching that's in Majjhima 19, for those interested, where he says, very simply, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. Can you argue with that? Pretty straightforward. If you frequently think and ponder upon how the world is a mess, everybody around is a jerk, and you're going to just be disappointed, you know you're going to be disappointed, that becomes the inclination of your mind and the filter through which you see life. And you will have ample evidence to corroborate your hypothesis. If you frequently think and ponder upon how amazing it is to be alive, how blessed your life is, how there's goodness in everybody, if we can just see, look carefully enough, and invite it out. If that's the inclination of your mind, if you frequently think and ponder upon it, that's what how you'll see life through. Not with denial, not with naivete, but you'll be able to recognize that when you see it. So cultivating wholesome states over a period of time consciously starts to incline the mind in that direction. Again, neuroscience confirms the Buddha's statement in the very simple and powerful axiom, neurons that fire together, wire together. The neural pathways that you've been practicing, that's the way your mind goes. They're set up. And if you start to fire new ways of seeing things, they start to wire in a different way. And so you start to incline your mind and your heart towards well-being. I'll give you a few examples of this. I'll tell you a little bit about the wholesome states, and we'll do a couple of maybe experiential exercises, then we'll take some questions. I can see I'm not going to get through the 10-month course. So the first wholesome state that's really the cornerstone of awakening joy or well-being is that of intention. Everything starts with intention. As the Tibetans say, everything rests on the tip of one's motivation. And if you have the intention to make well-being at the center of your life, then you do your part. It's not like you've got a report card going, is life passing or failing my test? You just incline the mind that way and value happiness. Many people don't realize that as much as they want to be happy, they've not put it at the center of their life. Everybody wants to be happy. Does anybody not want to be happy here? Now, if you're holding back your hand from saying, yeah, sometimes I don't want to be happy, you know, I can understand that. That's your way of being happy. Because we get misguided in thinking, oh, well, yeah, I have a right to be grumpy. Of course you have a right to be grumpy. This is going to make me feel better in some way to be grumpy. Or whatever. But we all want to be happy. So this is really getting in touch with that place in, deep inside of us that is wishing for our well-being. Isn't it there? That governs almost everything that you do, as misguided as sometimes it is. You want to be happy. So this is activating and empowering that place in you that really does want well-being. And when I say joy, by the way, that covers a whole lot of different expressions. I'm not talking about, oh yes, aren't we happy today, and putting a smiley smile on your face, and that's called denial, usually. But there's feelings of delight, and there's feelings of ease and contentment, and really happy people are not happy all the time. They're real, and they're engaged, but they see things with a bigger perspective. Starting with the intention to be happy, that makes all the difference in the world. It's just a decision to orient that as the center of your life, because it is the most important thing to us. Then you see, as I said, where real happiness lies. That leads to the second step of mindfulness, which is the underpinning for the whole course. Because as the Buddha said, it is the most direct way to overcome sorrow, lamentation, and grief and despair, pain and anxiety, and realize the highest happiness, to establish mindfulness. Because when you're mindful, you are present for your life and not lost in your stories. And mindfulness is the one factor that develops all the wholesome states, all the wholesome mental factors, and weakens all the unwholesome mental factors. It's got a very unique position in that way. And when you are present for the wholesome state, you amplify it, like I said before, taking in the good. A third, and this one I think we'll do an exercise with, is as you are present, there, mindfulness is really an appreciation practice. You are appreciating the present moment. And the flowering of appreciation is the grateful heart, which we all know is an extraordinary way to connect with the goodness inside and outside. Gratitude is probably the quickest, most direct way to awaken some joy and well-being. We'll just take a simple exercise to explore this right now, both with that feeling and also bringing mindfulness to it. So just close your eyes for a moment. And bring to mind either someone that you're grateful to, or grateful for, or some blessing in your life that you're grateful for. And whichever one that you pick, have an image right now, either of that person or that circumstance, so you can connect with this blessing. As you see that person or have that situation in mind, give thanks for a moment, just silently. Either thanking life or that person, thank you, and let yourself feel it. Thank you. And as you do, for a moment, turn your attention to how it feels, that capacity to feel grateful. What does it feel like in your body, in your mind? Let yourself take it in. Take a breath. We'll do it once again. Again, bring someone else or some other blessing to mind. Have an image that connects you with it or with them. And again, give thanks. Just silently, thank you. Let yourself feel it. Let yourself take it in. Relax into that grateful heart. And notice how it feels. Okay, if you'd like, you can open your eyes. Did you get it? It's just inclining the mind for a few moments. Any time that you see that is a chance for you. It doesn't take long. You know, according to the neuroscience, actually Rick Hansen has this, he was just the guest at the last Joy class. And all the classes, by the way, are recorded. They're on video and audio, and you can see them. And he was saying, you do that 6 times a day for 30 seconds, and you will notice a very profound difference within a couple of weeks, according to just how you're anchoring that in your mind. Now, you might say, well, you know, that's just not how I'm wired up. So I want to share with you one anecdote from the book, the personal one, probably my favorite anecdote in the whole book, because it's about my mom. And I'll just give you a sense of the possibilities. One year I was in Los Angeles visiting my then 89-year-old mother, and I brought with me a copy of Greater Good magazine, journal, which is an online journal of wellness and altruism, all the cutting edge research. And I said, my mom has a tendency to see the negative, by her own admission. She says, if she doesn't have anything to worry about, then she really gets worried. And she knows that her life has been blessed, but she just tends to see what's wrong. And I share with her all this research about boosting your immune system and all the ways that it's beneficial. And she said, sounds pretty good. I said, what do you think? She said, yeah, if I could do it, that would be great. But, you know, I'm 89. I've been doing it this way a long time. I don't think I can change. So I decided to, we were playing Scrabble when this happened. She's very good, loves to beat me, which she can do. And I said, okay, let's make a game out of it. Are you willing to make a game? She said, what do you mean? I said, okay, so suppose something goes wrong and you're there complaining, like the TV set going, getting poor reception. She said, okay, that's one I can relate to. I said, well, you can say either, oh, this is so annoying I could scream, Or you could say, oh, this is so annoying, I could scream, and my life is really very blessed. She said, yeah. I said, okay. She said, that makes sense, if I could remember it. I said, okay, how about every time a complaint comes out of you, I just say, and you say, and my life is very blessed. And she was game for it. She said, okay, let's do it. We were there. I spent a week down there. My sister was out of town. She lives very close to her. They're very close. And I had lots of different, lots of opportunities. And they rolled off her tongue. I said, and she said, oh yeah, and my life is very blessed. And we had a great week. Miraculously, she kept it up. I called her a lot after I got home. And, you know, and my sister came back 3 weeks later. She was overseas. And she said, what did you do to Mom? This is true. She wasn't entirely thrilled with it, because she kind of thinks that way too. But she got into it. She got used to it. Anyway, it took hold, and 7 months later, she wrote me a card. It was my birthday. We always exchange birthday poems. And she wrote this poem. During that time, she started to lose her eyesight, which amazingly has been restored. It's a kind of interesting situation. But at this point, she was losing her eyesight. This is part of the poem. 90 is just fine with me. I no longer rant and rave about where the world is heading and my exclusive job to save. I wallow in contentment and know that I am blessed, awakening to the joy of living at its best. I'm happier than I've ever been and truly mean each word. The thoughts that caused the worries now all seem so absurd. Though my eyesight has been dimmed, I see clearer than before. The glass is not half empty. It's overflowing, to be sure. So if my now 91-year-old mother can change, anyone can change. And it's kept up. A few months ago, we were having a conversation. I was just about to go to teach and talking, and she was talking about, oh, I was so blessed, and this blessing and that blessing. I said, Mom, you are so positive these days. She said, I'm having so many positive thoughts, it's positively exhausting. You can change. So, gratitude, I'll just briefly mention a few, and you can check out the others. The fourth step is dealing with the hard stuff. Because, you know, I have been teaching Buddhist philosophy for many years, and life is hard. It's the first noble truth. There's suffering in life. And if you can't learn to deal with that, you're going to be running up against a continual challenge to find well-being. But the Buddha actually said suffering, in one list, can be a causative factor for faith. Faith can be a causative factor for gladness. Gladness can be a causative factor for joy, up to contentment, happiness, contentment, equanimity, all the way to enlightenment. So he says suffering can lead to joy and beyond. You might say, how does that work? How many people were motivated to get into meditation practice or spiritual journey out of suffering in their life? Raise your hand. That's how it works. It can shake you out of your complacency and make you take a good look. What is really the meaning of life? And so part of this is learning to work with the difficulties and the pains in our heart and the losses that we experience so that we don't get overwhelmed by them. The gratitude and the wholesome states create more of a context where that suffering doesn't have to overwhelm. Where, as I'm sure many of you are familiar with the phrase, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, the fabric of life, that the joys can hold the sorrows. And if you're just focusing on the sorrows and how things are bad, then we get overwhelmed quite quickly. So working with the hard stuff, living a life of integrity, what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness, where you're aligned with your values. This is a source of deep happiness. And then there are other ones. Loving yourself is key. Loving others, expressing your compassion. And ultimately, the last step, after cultivating all of the wholesome states, the first nine, the tenth step is stopping doing anything and just be open to the joy of being, which has been here all along. When if you truly relax your struggling and open up and listen and feel the awareness that shines through you and the love that's shining through you, you see, it's been here all along. And so this joy of being is the kind of culmination of. But it's not like you start with one and then you do, and then you go to the end as a, you've got to perfect one. It's a holistic kind of thing. Wherever you enter into that intention for greater well-being, you are supporting all the others. So I think I'll stop here just so that there's some a chance for some discussion, and let you read the book if you want to find out more or take the course. So I'll just open it up here. Yeah.
I have a comment. Several of us that are here in 2000. Met together. I live in rural Minnesota, and so having some things online, and then we would come together once a month and talk about, well, so how's it going for you, and what happened to you? I found it really transformative, and I didn't do, honestly, a lot of the reading, but I was able to, you know, kind of get a lot out of it, so I'm really happy to have the book.
Oh, great. I'm happy you're here. Yeah. I knew she was coming.
No.
I'll pay you later on. That's the thing. It's the secret ingredient is just deciding, okay, I'm going to do this. And when you do it with others, it's very powerful. I encourage people to have a partner or a buddy or groups. There's lots of groups that form and support each other, and that connection is just very potent.
Can you do it online?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, connect cyberspace buddies. Yeah, there's ways to hook up with, there's a whole forum to connect with other people.
There's no future then for country music and the blues.
Oh, on the contrary. Okay, so yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Because actually, besides being based in Buddhist philosophy, there's a lot of supportive practices that I found particularly helpful to awaken joy and well-being, and singing is a big one. I encourage people, there's no failing, there's no pressure, you can't do this wrong, no guilt if you don't do other things, but if you really want to go for it, sing every day. Or sing as much as you can. Even the blues. If you're feeling really lousy, sing the blues. That's why they were created. And as far as singing, it aligns, it opens up your throat, it aligns you with a vibration, and when you're expressing yourself in that way, or any other way creatively, if singing isn't your thing, dancing, writing, drawing, letting life move through you is incredibly powerful. It gets you out of your head. So, sing. And we also, along with that, other supportive practices, being in your body. You know, I was so happy to take Mark's Qigong class this morning. It's good, you know, and it's good to just move your body so you get out of your head. Or having a gratitude practice, or keeping a little gratitude or a little journal lots of different things that you can support yourself. Finding a nourishment list. What really brings you well-being and happiness, and how often are you nourishing yourself? Because if you're not, you're coming from a place of depletion. And so you want to nourish yourself, as Shanti Deva says, it lifts you above the poverty into the wealth of giving to life when your heart is open, when you realize how precious this life is, when you realize, oh, there's awareness that is awakening in me. You don't want to come from a place of poverty. You want to come from a nourishment where you can give to life. And where you have more energy to look for the good, like Mark was saying in his lovely introduction, really a key principle is looking for the good in life. And if you look for it not only within you, but all around you, not only will you feel good, but you'll actually affect your environment. Just a little thing that I share most every retreat. If you're feeling, say somebody comes into a room and you sense they're seeing all your foibles and flaws, how do you feel? Flawed, don't you? Exposed, little, whatever. Feels lousy. Somebody else can come into a room. They might know every flaw or know all your weaknesses, but you know that they're seeing how beautiful you are. And that's what they're looking at. How do you feel? Beautiful. Or as sometimes it's said, bootiful. So we are very much affected by what others look for in us. If you keep on looking for the good, you have a better chance of drawing it out of them. Now, you can't do it with everybody, but you keep on looking for it, and it wants to come out. So you'll find that that's really a cornerstone of the practice.
So, Lauren, I have a very positive reaction towards life. I had some friends who, over the years, I have become kind of disconnected from. Because maybe they become curmudgeons, or else there's some negative baggage there. And I haven't figured out a way to connect back with them, because it doesn't resonate with how I function. And so, and I haven't read your book or any of your online courses, but I kind of feel bad that somehow those were people I was close with 30, 40 years ago. Now I can't get close to them. And there's other people, so it isn't like, yeah, oh my God, there's a big boy.
Yeah.
Still, they're there, they're people, and yet they're either curmudgeons or they're negative, and they have some baggage. Right? So how do you deal with that? I mean, other than this happy talk, which doesn't work.
No. But you still value the relationships and want to stay with them.
Well, kind of. I mean, think about it. If you're a positive person, you'd rather associate with other positive people.
It's
kind of human nature.
Yeah.
But other hand, so I'm ambivalent.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's another human being.
Yeah.
And are they lost to me? Are they lost to other people?
Yeah.
It's not my burden.
Right.
On the other hand, they're there.
Right. Right. It's it's a really important question, especially if there are people in your life who are important to you, who you love. They just don't see what they're creating in their minds. And the Buddha said very clearly, encourage to develop all the factors of enlightenment. The one common link is to avoid the company of those who don't value those factors, and to be in the company of the wise, because we are susceptible to our environment. So, for the most part, it makes sense to choose carefully what your environments are. That doesn't mean you cut them off, but you want to take them in small doses. And if they're not ready to see things your way, but you're not growing or feeling good about yourself or being around them, then you want to be really wise around how much you can be there. And don't expect to change people. Unless they want to change, it's unlikely they will. But if you keep on looking for the good in them when you're with them, and allowing for wellness to come out, you're not going to be convincing them, oh yes, isn't life wonderful? Give that one up. But you can just give them love. That's, you know, that's the best thing you can do. And you're, you know, hang out with people that you really value. But anyone can change. Here's one more. You just reminded me. You know the positive psychology movement, which has been radical in seeing not just pathology, but seeing the good. This was the start of the positive psychology movement. This guy, Martin Seligman, who wrote a book, Authentic Happiness. He was the father of the positive psychology movement. The moment took place in my garden while I was weeding with my 5-year-old daughter, Nikki. I have to confess that even though I write books about children, I'm not at all that good with them. I'm goal-oriented and time-urgent, and when I'm weeding in the garden, I'm actually trying to get the weeding done. Nikki, however, was throwing weeds into the air, singing and dancing around. I yelled at her. She walked away, came back, and said, "Daddy, I want to talk to you." "Yes, Nikki," I said. "Daddy, do you remember before my 5th birthday, from the time I was 3 to the time I was 5, I was a whiner. I whined every day. When I turned 5, I decided not to whine anymore. That was the hardest thing I've ever done. And if I can stop whining, you can stop being such a grouch." This was for me an epiphany, nothing less. Nikki hit the nail right on the head. I was a grouch. I'd spent 50 years mostly enduring wet weather in my soul, and the last 10 being a nimbus cloud in a household full of sunshine. Any good fortune I had was probably not due to my grumpiness, but in spite of it. In that moment, I resolved to change. That was the start of the positive psychology movement. So, not to give up on them, but just not to be to be butting your head against the wall and thinking, oh, they should be different than the way they are. Just keep loving them when you're around them. That's a good practice for you. Okay. It wasn't so much "I am a generous person." The words in the discourse say, "I am generous," or "I am being generous now." Actually, it says, "I am generous." But the idea that I get is, "I am being generous now." Notice how it feels when generosity moves through you. Not to identify and say, "I am such a generous person," but just that generosity moves through me. And to stay tuned when you have those spontaneous impulses, when there's a random act of kindness coming through you, so that you more and more incline towards that way, not defining yourself, because then you set yourself up when you're not being so generous or you're being a grump or whatever, and say, "Oh, I blew it." We have all of it inside of us, but to just focus more and more and see how good that feels, that wholesome state.
Maybe time for one more.
Yeah.
Well, I've often wondered if why, in a way, there's, you know, so many teachings of the Buddha that are so balanced, of seeing, you know, like two sides, and so why just 4 Noble Truths? Why don't we have 8? You know, where instead of seeing, you know, there is suffering, why isn't there the other 4 that say there is joy? You know, there's a
I see.
And to reflect on that also.
I see. Well, the 3rd Noble Truth, which is there is an end to suffering, is really about the highest happiness. It's just, it's put in the, you know, it's a standard formula. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this. The Buddha didn't so much point to, yes, it's this. Even Nibbana, you know, the unconditioned, the unborn, the not this. Take away all the conditioning, and what you have left is the deepest freedom. And so the third noble truth, there is an end to suffering, is really pointing to there is the highest happiness possible. And he talks quite specifically about all the wholesome states in other discourses. It's just that that third noble truth captures everything. You just have to go looking a little bit to understand it that way. So, is that it? It's been a real joy, I can say, to be with you. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for coming, everybody.